Today is Wednesday, April 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump takes issue with the World Health Organization.
The WHO failed to adequately obtain, vet, and share information in a timely and transparent fashion.
Plus, how much power does the president have?
The president is clearly spoiling for a fight on this issue.
And 50 years later, we revisit a problem Houston had to solve. Those stories and more are next. U.S. President Donald Trump says he's cutting off U.S. payments to the World Health Organization, accusing it of failing to do enough to stop the coronavirus from spreading when it first surfaced in China. The move has drawn widespread international condemnation, including from some traditional allies, such as Germany, and from aid activists, such as billionaire philanthropist Bill Gates. AP correspondent Ben Thomas starts us off.
The WHO failed to adequately obtain, vet, and share information in a timely and transparent fashion.
At the White House's daily coronavirus briefing, the president accused the WHO of
severely mismanaging and covering up the spread of the coronavirus.
But Trump himself showed deference to China at the beginning stages of the outbreak, on February 7th telling reporters,
"I had a great conversation last night with President Xi. It's a tough situation. I think they're doing a very good job."
The head of the American Medical Association says what's needed right now to fight the virus is international cooperation, along with science and data. AMA President Patrice Harris says cutting funding to the WHO rather than focusing on solutions is a dangerous move at a precarious moment for the world. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres says now is not the time to end support for the WHO, calling the organization absolutely critical to the global effort to combat COVID-19. He adds an appropriate time for a review is once we have finally turned the page on this pandemic. Ben Thomas, Washington.
Like governments all over the world, the United States is debating when to reopen its economy. With COVID-19 infections believed to be peaking in several parts of the U.S., politicians, economists, and doctors are discussing whether it will be safe in the coming weeks for people to leave their homes and return to work. Before the country decides when to reopen the economy, political leaders disputed who has the authority to make the decision. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikuswara has this story.
The 1935 film Mutiny on the Bounty is about a rebellion by the ship's crew over the captain's management style. In a tweet Tuesday, President Donald Trump said it was one of his favorite movies, commenting, "especially when the mutineers need so much from the captain." Trump presumably was referring to a group of Democratic governors who are banding together to collectively decide when they want to reopen their states.
The president is clearly spoiling for a fight on this issue. The worst thing we can do in all of this is start with political division.
New York's Andrew Cuomo and other governors are working together to develop a strategy for gradually easing stay-at-home restrictions in their states. President Trump says that decision is not entirely up to them. Responding to VOA's question on Monday, Trump declared that he has total authority on the issue.
I'm going to put it very simply. The president of the United States has the authority to do what the president has the authority to do, which is very powerful. The president of the United States calls the shots.
Trump's statement started a firestorm on state versus federal authority in a national emergency.
On its face, what President Trump said is simply wrong. There is no sort of plenary authority in the president, even in times of emergency, to have, you know, total authority to do whatever he wants.
Yes. Governors have pushed back, including Michigan's Gretchen Whitmer.
There's nobody who would rather be able to push a button and just return to life as normal. But no button exists in this environment.
During the pandemic, the federal government has helped ensure states have the supplies and resources to take care of their citizens. Lawmakers have also passed a $2 trillion plan to support the economy. But governors and mayors have the authority over local matters of public health and safety, including keeping people in their homes and closing businesses.
The president has every incentive to want to improve the economy. He has a lot of financial wherewithal at his disposal to do so. It puts him in a very different position than the governors and the mayors, who are the frontline defense in terms of keeping people at home to protect public safety, but in ways that really do keep the economy limited.
Despite disagreements over who can order the nation's slow return to normalcy, ultimately the virus will determine its own timeline, said Trump's top health expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
I think how you reopen, if you want to use that word, the economy in those communities is going to depend a lot on the ability to contain what we know will happen. I'll guarantee you, once you start pulling back, there will be infections. It's how you deal with the infection that's going to count.
Trump has considered opening up parts of the country as early as May 1st. Dr. Fauci says that may be overly optimistic. Patsy Widakuswara, BOA News.
There are currently about 2 million confirmed cases of COVID-19 globally, according to a Johns Hopkins University tracker. Lockdowns in Africa are limiting the movement of people in an attempt to slow the spread of the coronavirus and is threatening to choke off supplies of what the continent needs the most, food. At least 33 of Africa's 54 countries have lockdowns or partial shutdowns in place because the virus and the UN's World Food Program, the World Bank, and others are warning there could be severe food crises. Africa is already struggling to feed its 1.3 billion people. Nearly 250 million people don't have enough food because of floods, drought, swarms of locusts, armed conflicts, and government failures. Now Africa's poor are being hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. The UN Refugee Agency warns the return of tens of thousands of refugees to Afghanistan from Pakistan and Iran risks overwhelming the country's medical system and spreading the coronavirus. Lisa Schlein has that story.
Pakistan and Iran host some 2.4 million Afghan refugees. Despite persistent risks and insecurity in Afghanistan, thousands of refugees continue to return home. The UN Refugee Agency reports tens of thousands have crossed over the border from Pakistan in the past week, and in March, about 60,000 have gone back from Iran. UNHCR spokesman Baba Balar says Afghan refugees are returning home at an average daily rate of 1,500. He says the coronavirus poses a great threat to Afghanistan's fragile health system and risks overwhelming its medical and social services capacity. He adds COVID-19 also is putting immense strain on the health systems and economies of Pakistan and Iran. He says many Afghan refugees are unable to meet their most basic needs because of the sharp economic downturn in their host countries.
In both countries, those who are employed are commonly hired as daily wage laborers. Amidst the various levels of lockdowns across the region, such work has abruptly ceased, and refugees are left with no income, and their hosts are now faced with economic threats to their survival.
So far, Afghanistan has recorded only a few hundred cases of coronavirus and about two dozen deaths. Pakistan has registered nearly 6,000 cases and around 100 deaths. But the World Health Organization reports Iran, with more than 73,000 cases and nearly 5,000 deaths, is the epicenter of the outbreak in Southwest Asia. Balish says the UNHCR has temporarily suspended the voluntary repatriation of Afghans from Iran and Pakistan in hopes of limiting the risk of refugees and staff contracting the deadly virus. The UNHCR is appealing for greater international support for all three countries to prevent a larger-scale outbreak of the disease. It says its humanitarian operation in the region is on life support, noting that only 17% of its $315 million appeal has been funded. The agency warns failure to support Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Iran in their desperate efforts to stave off the pandemic will impact negatively on global efforts to fight the virus. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Koreans began going to the polls on Wednesday to elect members of parliament, wearing masks and plastic gloves as part of strict safety measures in one of the first national elections being held amid the coronavirus pandemic. Reuters' Ryan Brooks has more.
South Korea went to the polls on Wednesday, one of the first countries to do so since the global pandemic began. While other nations have postponed or delayed votes, South Koreans are choosing lawmakers while taking strict steps to stay healthy. Anyone lining up to vote must stand at least a meter or 3 feet apart. Then a temperature check, a squirt of sanitizer, and plastic gloves. Anyone whose temperature is too high gets taken to a special booth. All of that seemed to reassure people at the polls.
I thought the election would be postponed, so I was very worried since it took place as scheduled. Wearing gloves and keeping a distance from other people were not that difficult, and I saw many staff working hard for voters.
South Korea was one of the first countries to face a large outbreak outside of mainland China, but it's largely managed to bring its cases under control thanks to massive testing and intense contact tracing. With that success and the election day limits, officials allowed this vote to go forward. There's already been 5 days of early voting to try and reduce crowding on election day, and even coronavirus patients have been voting by mail or in special polling stations. More than 13,000 in self-quarantine will also be allowed to vote after others leave at 6 p.m. The election is set to decide control of parliament and shape President Moon Jae-in's ability to push through his agenda in the last 2 years of his time in office.
That was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks. And coming up later...
It had been a major sound, metallic echoing bang came through the spacecraft. So we knew it was nothing normal, quite something probably bad.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
When COVID-19 was first detected, scientists went to work to determine the path of the viral infection as it made its way from animal to human. Scientists think that the SARS coronavirus 2, which causes COVID-19, originated in bats. But what was the animal after bats to cause the coronavirus to make its jump to humans? Snakes and a scaly mammal called the pangolin were first suspected to be the viral culprits. In a new study published online by Molecular Biology and Evolution, Shua Xia, a University of Ottawa biology professor, proposes that a stray dog may have passed the virus on to humans. Professor Xia theorizes that a predecessor of the SARS coronavirus 2 infected the intestine of a member of the canine family, resulting in the virus to evolve quickly enough to make its jump to humans. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. After 2 weeks of forced quarantine, hundreds of refugees in Turkey have been released haphazardly, with many dropped off in locked-down coastal areas and told, go find a boat to Greece. Other families are finding their official refugee status. The documents that protect them from deportation have been revoked at a time when, on some days, even being out in the street is against the law. Thousands more refugees are still being held in quarantine and are expected to be released in the coming days. VOA's Heather Murdoch has this story.
After more than 2 weeks of forced quarantine, hundreds of refugees in Turkey have been released haphazardly, with many being dropped off on the streets in locked-down coastal areas and told to get a boat to Greece. Thousands more are still held in quarantine and are expected to be released in the coming days and weeks. In late February, Turkey announced it would open its border with Greece. With this encouragement, as many as 12,000 refugees flocked to the border, hoping to cross. But Greece never said it would open its border, and it never did. Greek soldiers pushed the refugees back to Turkey by force. By the end of March, coronavirus was beginning to spread in Turkey, and authorities evacuated the refugees from the border camp, quarantining the families and cutting their contact with the outside world. Greece accuses Turkey of preparing to flood the country with refugees, contradicting a 2016 agreement in which Turkey said it would keep people out of Europe in exchange for aid for Syrian refugees. Turkey says Europe has never fully delivered on the 2016 promises and accuses Greece of human rights abuses. Both countries say they don't want to take in more refugees during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. refugees, many now living on the streets, say while the international community squabbles, their families' lives are at risk from exposure, hunger, and also the virus. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Istanbul.
In his first interview since being released from prison, Australia's Cardinal George Pell has said his hardline conservative views on social issues were the reason he was prosecuted. Pell's convictions for child abuse were unanimously quashed by Australia's High Court earlier this month. Phil Mercer reports.
Cardinal George Pell was the world's most senior Catholic official to be jailed for child abuse. He served more than a year of a six-year prison sentence after being found guilty of sexually assaulting two choir boys in a cathedral in the city of Melbourne in the 1990s. He'd always protested his innocence and this month was acquitted by Australia's High Court. It found there was a reasonable doubt that Pell had the time or the opportunity to commit the alleged crimes after a busy Sunday Mass almost 25 years ago. In an interview with Australia's Sky News, Cardinal Pell has spoken publicly for the first time since his release from prison. He described the complainant who testified against him as a poor fellow and said the man may have been manipulated by Pell's critics. The former Vatican treasurer said he was a casualty of a so-called culture war with opponents who disliked his conservative views on same-sex marriage and abortion. Pell also took aim at the justice system in the state of Victoria, where he was convicted after a trial in December 2018. Cardinal Pell said it weighed too heavily in favour of alleged victims of abuse.
We need good policemen. We need good judges, good prosecutors. It's not a sign of a civilization where you have guilt by accusation. The pendulum 30, 40 years ago was massively against anybody who said that they'd been attacked. Nowadays, we don't want it to swing back so that every accusation is regarded as gospel truth.
It's now being reported that Cardinal Pell faces fresh allegations from a new accuser. Pell has told Australian TV he wouldn't be entirely surprised if police came after him again. Asked at a media conference if the force had a vendetta against the former Archbishop of Melbourne and Sydney, Victoria's Deputy Police Commissioner Shane Patton said he had no comment to make in respect to Cardinal Pell. Police in Sydney have investigated threats made on social media against the 78-year-old Cardinal Pell since his release. The former papal advisor spent more than 400 days in jail before being freed on April 7. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A year on from the inferno that gutted the Notre Dame de Paris and stunned the world, the cathedral's great bell will ring out Wednesday evening as a mark of the building's resilience and that of the medics battling France's coronavirus epidemic. Now, to get the full picture, I spoke with Nicolas Pinault via WhatsApp in Paris.
Well, the initial plan was to have a big ceremony that would have taken place around Notre Dame. President Macron would have made a speech, but of course, the plan has changed because the world and France battled the pandemic. So it would just be the bell inside Notre Dame that will ring at 8 p.m. local time when French people applaud at the windows to thank doctors, nurses, and all health workers fighting the virus. So it's going to be very discreet. And politically speaking, French President Emmanuel Macron vowed to do his best to ensure the cathedral reconstruction will be finished by 2024. It's very ambitious, but he maintained that goal on a Twitter video this morning.
How far have they come along, and do you know what is being hindered by the current lockdown?
Right now, everything has paused. Repair work has halted mid-March. As you said, France imposed a lockdown. So right now there's no worker working on the site itself. Everything has been delayed probably until maybe the summer to make sure that they need to take additional security measures. Because the big problem right now is the lead poisoning on the site. That's something they've been very, very careful. And right now reconstruction efforts have not started yet, the real reconstruction. Because what they need to do right now, and this is very sensitive, they need to remove the scaffolding. And part of the scaffolding has melted also in the fire. So it's very, very sensitive.
That was reporter Nicolas Pinault speaking to me from Paris. One of the most remarkable achievements in the U.S. space program wasn't achieving a goal, but preventing a disaster 50 years ago when a mission to land on the moon went horribly wrong. Through extensive VOA interviews with Apollo 13 astronauts and mission control members who worked through the harrowing crisis, VOA's Kane Faribault revisits NASA's successful failure when the eyes of the world focus on the astronauts in great peril.
Ignition, Fred.
By the time America's third mission to land on the moon, Apollo 13, lifted off on April 11, 1970, travel to the desolate orb seemed about as noteworthy as commuting to work.
I think the only mention in the New York Times was on page 67 of the weather page. Very few people in the news media had manned the news desk at the Johnson Space Center.
That changed 3 days into the mission, when a terrifying explosion rocked the spacecraft carrying astronauts Jim Lovell, Jack Swigert, and Fred Hayes.
It had been a major sound, metallic echoing bang came through the spacecraft. So we knew it was nothing normal, quite something probably bad.
And we had a pretty large bang associated with the caution and warning there.
At NASA's Johnson Space Center in Houston, Texas,
Houston, we've had a problem.
Flight Director Gene Kranz frantically worked to turn a certain catastrophe into a successful recovery.
And we had three crewmen in a dead spacecraft 200,000 miles from Earth going towards the moon.
Getting them back alive meant around-the-clock problem solving and abandoning the mission they trained for.
I was sick to my stomach because I knew we weren't going to be able to land on the moon.
For the crewmen of the Apollo 13, we'll hold silence for a moment, please.
As the world followed the crisis on radio and television, Kranz's mantra during Apollo 13 became the title of his book, Failure is Not an Option.
The crisis lasted the best part of almost 4 days, and that was where maybe the world's attention was able to be focused upon this particular event more than some of the other missions that we focused on.
The team that was trained to handle emergencies like that and like many other things did their job with great credit, and as a result, the spacecraft and the crew came back safely.
Years later, when we decided to write a book about the story of Apollo 13, that I got the feeling that, yes, the flight was a failure in one aspect, but in the other aspect, it was a triumph on how people can take an almost certain catastrophe, the mission control people and the flight crew, working together, figuring out solutions to crises that we didn't plan for, we didn't train for, and get this spacecraft back home.
Hey, we've got a problem here.
Lovell's book, titled Lost Moon, was the basis for the 1995 Apollo 13 Hollywood blockbuster.
Houston, we have a problem.
Featuring actor Tom Hanks as Lovell.
Sometimes stories that we see in movies are based in reality and you have to sort of increase the drama. This one was a real drama. It was not clear that these guys were going to be able to get home alive. And so that's why it makes such a good story and why I think it grabbed people's attention.
It's a story highlighted at the Adler Planetarium's Mission Moon exhibit, showcasing equipment from Apollo 13 donated by Lovell, who hopes to inspire a new generation of explorers.
Quite a few of the population just here coming through the Adler Planetarium wasn't around when we actually did our Apollo flights.
While an Adler Planetarium event to celebrate Apollo 13's 50th anniversary is postponed due to the coronavirus outbreak,
I hereby declare that this was a successful mission.
The celebration is moving online.
The voyage of Apollo 13 dramatized its risks.
Where visitors to the Adler and NASA social media sites can see and hear highlights of the U.S. space program's successful failure. Kane Faribault, VOA News, Chicago, Illinois.
And that'll do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.